It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, fewer people are driving or traveling by plane. A Wisconsin researcher tells us we're getting an unexpected experiment in air pollution here in the state and around the country. Now we all have a different relationship with food. Some of us might be focused on counting calories. Others might feel some guilt after eating something sugary, or get stressed and skip meals altogether, or get stressed and eat even more. Our next guest says all this attention to what we're eating can have negative effects. Instead, we should focus on when and why we're eating to get closer to what she calls a normal relationship with food. Abby Langer is a registered dietitian and has worked in clinical nutrition and nutrition media and consulting. She writes about debunking fad diets and nutrition myths on her website, abbylangernutrition.com. She wrote the piece, "This is what it looks like to have a normal relationship with food for self.com." Abby, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what do you mean by a normal relationship with food?
Now, it's important to know that normal and healthy are two completely different things. This doesn't mean having a normal relationship with food doesn't mean you eat a lot of salads and, you know, you cut down on your sugar. Normal is more along the lines of knowing why you eat and having a healthy attitude towards food and a healthy relationship with food.
A lot of us don't. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that affects most of us at one point or another, and some for longer than others. You know, we have such a diet culture, and there's this thin ideal that a lot of people or most of us strive for. And, you know, it really takes a toll on our relationship with food, because we're using all these external cues to sort of achieve something, some arbitrary idea of how we should look and how we should feel. And in doing that, we ignore what our bodies are telling us.
How do we tune ourselves into what our bodies are telling us?
So I think the first step is to understand that we understand what those external cues are, and to take a look at, you know, the way you perceive food and eating. If you're saying, you know, this food is bad and this other food is good and I'm eating clean and, you know, I'm such a horrible person because I ate this cake, those are symptoms of being basically under the influence of a diet mentality. So I think the first step would be to understand that we need to step away from that diet mentality by knowing that it's normal to eat and it's normal to feel hungry, and that guilt and shame do not play well with food and eating ever.
Abby Langer is with us, registered dietitian, talking about having a normal relationship with food. Abby, you have a manifesto up on your website, and one of the points on there has to do with that shame and the guilt that I think a lot of people feel after some bit of indulgence or another. How does that hurt us?
Well, it makes us eat more in the end, a lot of the time, because we feel so bad about ourselves, you know. And research has shown that people who feel guilt and shame around eating actually tend to eat more. And I think it's important to note shame and guilt around food. It hurts us because when we feel that a food is shameful, or we feel guilty, or after we eat it, or that a food is good or it's bad, we tend to internalize those labels to ourselves. So let's say you eat a piece of cake and you think it's such a bad food. People tend to think, I'm eating a bad food and therefore I am bad. And it's a terrible thing, because obviously intellectually we know we're not bad people for eating a piece of cake, but this is how diet culture works.
Now, suppose, as you said, normal doesn't necessarily mean the same as healthy eating. I could envision a world in which I ate lots of donuts and managed to erase my shame. I could eat a lot of bad food in a way that makes me unhealthy. How do I make sure that, you know, getting rid of that shame, feeling normal about how I eat, doesn't turn too unhealthy?
you know, I think it's important to respect your body and to respect your hunger and fullness cues. And that's what normal eating entails, is to respect your body by choosing mostly nourishing foods. It's not an excuse for a free-for-all with donuts or pizza, although no food is restricted, which can be very difficult for people. You know, I tell people, people always ask me, what food would you never eat, or what food should we never eat? And I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I really eat everything as a dietitian. I still eat Oreo cookies. I still eat pizza. But is my diet based on those things? No, but I don't feel bad when I eat that. That's normal eating. I mean, I think, you know, we've been on restrictive diets with such long lists of rules for so long, that we're so afraid to integrate less nourishing foods into our diets. But just choosing mostly nourishing foods and understanding when we don't choose those foods, that it's totally normal. As long as, you know, you don't do it every single meal.
Why do we love really restrictive or unusual diets? Because it seems like we really gravitate toward those. Is it just like the no pain, no gain thing? We want to feel like we're suffering to do better?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, I think people are really out for a quick fix, and they feel as though if something's really strange or they haven't heard of it before, maybe it's just that one thing that's going to do the trick. Although if you ask people to really sit and think about it intellectually, they will know, most of them will tell you that it probably won't work. I also think there's a need to belong. And I write about this all the time where, you know, diets are getting more extreme. Their newest one is the carnivore diet, where people eat nothing but meat and salt and water. And that's it. They don't eat. They think vegetables are horrible for you. It's just a very restrictive, obviously, diet. And I think it comes from the need to belong to one of these diet tribes. We are so connected in the world, yet we're so alone. And studies have shown that we're actually lonelier than ever before, even though everyone's connected via the internet and all of that. And I think, you know, it's a substitute for actual interpersonal relationships, is feeling like you're part of a group, that you're doing something special, that you have some special knowledge of this diet. It's like a special club. Makes people feel supported.
We're talking with Abby Langer, a registered dietitian. She writes about debunking fad diets, nutrition myths, and more at her website, abbylangernutrition.com. She says we need to rebuild a normal relationship with our food. We want to hear from you. Have you found an approach to eating that works for you? How do you handle those times when you find yourself emotional eating, be it stress or other? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue the conversation with Abby Langer, registered dietitian. She wrote the piece, "This is what it looks like to have a normal relationship with food," for self.com. We want to hear from you online. Do you feel guilty after eating a big meal or a sweet treat? How would you like to change your own relationship with food? Or have you done that in a positive way? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you're thinking. Taylor is with us in Madison. Taylor, hi.
Hi, thanks so much. I just wanted to say that I've been down that road of restrictive diets, like the low carbs, lots of meat and vegetables. But at the same time, you know, I've now come to a more healthy approach with food, of loving all kinds of food, you know, so, and that includes having cake and beer and cheese curds. And from that result, it's just been, I'm a much more loving relationship with myself and food, because those restrictive diets are just so stressful, and you know, you should enjoy food. That's what it's there for.
Taylor, thanks a lot for the call. Abby, what do you think?
I think that's so fantastic. I'm just nodding as Taylor's talking, because, and I love how she said cheese curds, because you're in Wisconsin. I'm
we
in
sure
Toronto.
Are.
I think that's so fantastic. And it's so great to hear from someone who's been through everything and then come out the other side and has found peace and a good relationship with food and with your body. I think that's so awesome.
Taylor, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Lynn with us in Bayview. Lynn, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Lynn?
Well, ever since I was a kid, my parents wanted to feed me breakfast, lunch, and supper and their menu. But I always objected to that. I ate what I wanted, when I wanted. Drove them crazy. But I'm 52, and I weigh the same as I weighed in high school. And I always eat what I want, when I want to. So if I want chicken soup for breakfast, that's what I eat.
Yeah.
If I want a salad at midnight, that's what I eat.
And
I don't, like, yeah, I don't do societal norms, like, you have to eat three meals a day. I might eat eight meals a day. They might be really tiny meals, but they're what I want. So I just pay attention to what I want to eat, and that's what I eat.
Lynn, thank you so much. Abby, it sounds like you're nodding along there again.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love it.
And that makes me think of, you know, I'm a parent myself, and I've been there, that stressful, almost combat zone with the kids, trying to get them to eat the good stuff when the parent wants. I'm as guilty as Lynn's parents were of that. How can we get past that as parents?
Well, first of all, stop referring to food as good or bad, because there is no good or bad food. And I think also it's important to set a good example for our kids. So if they see you eating the foods that they that you want them to eat, then they will more likely than not eat them. But don't, I always tell clients, if you make it a big deal, it's going to be a big deal. You know how kids, when you tell them to do something, they never want to do it. But if you just leave them alone, then they're more likely to do whatever you want them to do. So if, for example, you want them to eat broccoli, you put it on their plate. If they eat it, that's great. Don't say anything. If they don't eat it, that's fine. Don't say anything. Just take it away and continue to offer them the foods that you want them to eat. I think it's also important to make the connection between the way kids eat and the way we eat, because kids are naturally intuitive with their eating. They're born eating when they're hungry and then stopping when they're full. And they eat what they want, and then they don't eat what they don't want. So they won't just see a burger and think, oh, I'm not hungry, but I'm going to eat that anyways because it looks good. If they're not hungry, they're not going to eat it. They're operating on their internal hunger and fullness cues. We don't do that because we're affected by so many outside influences. So it's almost like I'm saying eat more like a child, except, you know, eat more vegetables. But yeah, so it's interesting to watch kids eat, but setting a good example, not making a big deal about what they're eating or what they're not eating, and knowing that nothing bad's going to happen if the kid hates vegetables for a couple of years. Like, just relax. They know when you're stressed. If they know you're stressed, it's going to work against you.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jonathan joins us in Janesville now. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your story, Jonathan?
About 10 years ago, I lost about 100 pounds. Most of my adolescence, I was obese. And my whole journey was based on learning to love food and appreciate food. And eventually I went to culinary school and developed this love a little bit more. But in this country, we don't have a real connection with real food. We don't love food the way that many other cultures around the world do. And that's something that I've found, that developing that love and understanding of food and cooking has allowed me to be able to enjoy food anytime, and so to have a real relationship with food that we don't, you know, that we don't currently have in this country. And
Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing that. I think a lot of times, Abby, especially when we're talking about obesity, the approach is to shun food, battle with food, view food as the enemy. Jonathan did exactly the opposite and did pretty well, it sounds like.
I think it's so, having just been to Italy for the second time, I know exactly what he's talking about, because the food there is so beautiful and they really appreciate the beauty of food. Here it's like, let's just eat in the car on the way to work and, you know, not even taste our food. A lot of things are ultra processed. Couldn't be more different over there. And I think that's a great way to eat, the way most European countries eat.
Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Abby, how do we get there from here for people who are stressed out? They feel shame about the food they eat. They're watching for the superfood and the food to avoid.
Yeah.
How do we get from there to that normal relationship?
You know that there's no quick fix, and know that you can trust your body. And it's a process. And, you know, what I know that the way I'm saying it is making it sound like I think it's easy, but I don't think it's easy. Of course not. And if you've been eating a certain way for your whole life or for the majority of your adult life, it's very hard to then shut off the diet behaviors and to start trusting your body. But know that your body will ask for food when you're hungry, and it will give you satiety cues, like fullness cues, when it's full. And if you eat the majority of your food whole or minimally processed, then you should have some satisfaction with the foods that you're eating. But also know that it's not worth it to beat yourself up about eating in the way that the diet culture says is bad. Like, there's no good foods, bad foods. You are not your diet. And food isn't the enemy or something to be feared. We're so afraid of eating. And I want people to revel in the beauty of food and have a good relationship with food and their bodies. It takes time.
Abby, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Registered dietitian Abby Langer writes about debunking fad diets and nutrition myths on her website, abbylangernutrition.com. She wrote the piece, "This is what it looks like to have a normal relationship with food for self.com."
I'm Kate Archer Kent here with my colleague Rob Ferret. And in response to the uncertainty caused by COVID-19, today is Giving Tuesday Now. It's a global day of support for the organizations that make a difference in our communities.
Join the movement with your gift to WPR at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Your generosity keeps us connected with essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and inspiring music.
You know, it's a great time to give because right now we have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $25,000. And this generous Giving Tuesday Now match is from current members. It means they'll double every dollar you give.
It's their way of encouraging you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. Double your support right now at 888-202-2552. Or online at WPR.org.
It's listener support that is the biggest source of funding for the WPR programs you value. You make the difference.
Trustworthy, independent journalism has a home on Wisconsin Public Radio thanks to you. Make your gift now for the quality you rely on at 888-202-2552. Or WPR.org.
You yourself rely on WPR, and you probably also care that everyone in the state has access to this high-quality source of information. The best way to make that happen is to become a member with a contribution of any amount, say $10 a month.
When you do, you're not only doing something good for yourself, you're doing something good for the whole community. WPR is listener-supported. That's why your participation is so important on this Giving Tuesday Now. Give now at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
We are all committed to making our communities better. Right now, that means staying at home for many of us and going out for essential work for others. And it means supporting the people and organizations we care about. Your financial contribution to Wisconsin Public Radio also makes the community a better place.
That's because your investment, together with donations from others, makes the news, talk, and music on WPR available to everyone. We're proud to be an important part of the Wisconsin community, especially right now when access to information is so important. It's all possible thanks to your support. Join in now with your gift at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
Giving Tuesday Now is a great time to join together with people all over the world to support the organizations you value. To inspire you to support Wisconsin Public Radio, current members will match your gift today up to $25,000.
Double the impact of your gift when you donate to WPR now at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
More than 25,000 WPR members are proud sustainers, and that means they make ongoing monthly gifts to Wisconsin Public Radio.
You too can provide a reliable stream of funding for the programs you care about. Become a sustainer this Giving Tuesday Now. Choose an amount that's right for you, say 10 or 20 bucks a month, and set it up to be ongoing. It's easy to do, and it makes such an important difference at 888-202-2552.
2552 or WPR.org.
Our Giving Tuesday Now dollar for dollar match still in effect. It's a great time to support the WPR programs you love because your support of WPR will go twice as far when you give at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org.
There are so many organizations that are providing important services at this time. WPR and NPR are uniquely positioned to cover the coronavirus pandemic. We have reporters based all over Wisconsin, and NPR has bureaus all over the country and the world. You can count on us for the news you need at this difficult time. Your gift now at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org makes it all possible.
We've heard from a lot of listeners who are finding WPR more important than ever. Lynn from Undell donated and said, you know, I'm a longtime donor. WPR, especially at this time, is the most objective source of information from a wide variety of sources. Thank you for your support, Lynn.
Your gift makes a difference for the essential news, community conversations, and classical music that you value on Wisconsin Public Radio. Give now, 888-202-2552 or WPR.org, and thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a Wisconsin project on air pollution and how air quality is being affected as fewer people are driving cars these days. And by the way, want to hear from you over on the Ideas Network Facebook page on a couple topics. Later on today, we're going to look at the history and present of hobbies. Our question for you is, are you getting into a hobby these days? Have you gotten back into something? And if you have a longtime hobby, who taught it to you in the first place? Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And then tomorrow, looking forward to this, we're going to hear from Bob Bonnader over at the Planetarium down Milwaukee Way. And we're going to get a preview of the night sky coming up over the next few months. Want to know if you are a stargazer, a really good one, and you could pick out constellations or you just like looking up at night, like me, and you don't necessarily know anything apart from maybe the Big Dipper. Again, let us know about your hobbies, and if you have a hobby of stargazing, let us know about that, too, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Stick around. There's more to come after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The state Supreme Court heard arguments today on a Republican lawsuit seeking to end Wisconsin's stay-at-home order. We'll talk about what was said and how the case may play out coming up. First, in this time of safer-at-home guidance and restrictions on travel, we also find ourselves living in an unintended experiment. We're seeing reports of clearer skies in China, Italy, and India with reduced nitrogen dioxide levels in major cities and metropolitan areas. NASA cited data showing a 30% drop in nitrogen dioxide in a corridor from Washington, D.C. to Boston. That's comparing March of this year to the average in March going back to 2015. Brad Pierce is an academic program director at the UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center and an expert on forecasting global air quality. Brad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob.
Well, can you talk about what you are looking at when it comes to air pollution, specifically this nitrogen dioxide during this time where we're driving a lot less?
Yeah, so you talked a little bit about the NASA reporting on the reductions in nitrogen dioxide. They're using an instrument that has been in orbit for quite a while, so they're able to look at how different it is compared to a long-term record. I'm looking at some data from a fairly new instrument that was launched by the European Space Agency in 2018, and it's a higher resolution instrument. It's able to dwell down and look more closely at urban areas. So we're taking a closer look at that in the Midwest area.
Before we dig into the trends here, what is nitrogen dioxide? Why do we worry about how much of it is in our local airways?
So nitrogen dioxide is a pollutant in and of itself, and it has adverse health impacts. But generally what we're concerned about nitrogen dioxide for is because it's one of those pollutants that is emitted from cars and power plants and factories that can lead to both ozone production and lead to high ozone levels, and also to forming nitrate aerosols, which are one of the aerosol pollutants that we see in the Midwest in particular.
And these are things that can have health impacts for us here on the ground?
Right. So ozone and aerosols, the small particulates, definitely have health impacts, and that's why the EPA regulates the levels of those.
Now, here we are. We're driving, as I said, a lot less. What are we seeing here in the U.S. In this instrument you're looking from when it comes to our nitrogen dioxide levels?
So we've kind of just begun looking at the data. Again, it hasn't been up for a long time. So what we're doing is we're comparing last March and April 2019 to 2020, the period when the Safer at Home policies began to be implemented. And we're seeing a fairly complicated picture. In large parts of the country, there's reductions, but in some parts, and even by some urban centers, we're seeing actual increases in the amount of NO2 in the column. And so we have to take into account not just changes in the emissions because of reductions in automobile traffic, but we also have to take into account differences in the meteorology, just how the wind was blowing between last year and this year. So we're trying to tease out those two different processes so we can get a better understanding of what the impact was with regard to changes in emissions.
We're talking to Brad Pierce from the UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center, looking at air pollution during a time of safer at home orders and how we're trying to figure out the sources of air pollution, what is changing as we're driving less. Brad, this is in effect an unplanned experiment for people in your line of work. What kind of lessons are you hoping we can learn from this as you try to, as you say, digest that data?
So one of the big uncertainties in understanding the emissions of these pollutants is, what's the relative importance of different sectors in those emissions? So what is the contribution from automobiles? What's the contribution from heavy-duty trucks? What's the contribution due to more distributed sources and industry? And so here we have a really good understanding of what the reduction in automobile miles is, and from that we can infer what sort of change we would expect given our current understanding of the emission inventory. And then we can compare that with the satellite data to see if our current understanding is right. So once we have that, then we're able to improve our emission estimates so that we know better what fraction is associated with this automobile traffic.
It sounds complicated because for especially the industrial side of this, some factories are closed, some are essential, and they're open. Are you going to have to kind of drill down into that economic data to see what's still running and what's not as you try to match it up to what's in the satellite?
So what we're doing right now is we're trying to put together a rapid response proposal to NASA. And at least for this phase, we're going to focus on the automobile component of those emissions. And that's because we're collaborating with a professor on campus, Song Gao, who's in the geography department, who has very detailed data on a county level about changes in automobile miles traveled based on cell phone data. So for this study, we think we have a good idea about automobile miles. We know how much they've been reduced, and we can at least understand whether our understanding of the fraction of the total emissions that's due to cars is correct.
What do we know about longer-term trends when it comes to the pollution that we're talking about, the nitrogen dioxide?
Yeah, so longer-term trends are that that the nitrogen dioxide pollutants have been going down significantly over the last decade or so. And so that's what makes some of the comparisons to a longer-term climatology a little difficult to interpret, because there is, you know, there's reductions that have nothing to do with the current pandemic, that just have to do with improved emission controls over the last decade or so.
Interesting. And then from year to year, I imagine, for what you're saying about weather patterns, it must vary in different, I don't know, cities, counties, things like that, just based on, in effect, which way the wind's blowing?
Exactly. And that's the part that I'm actually working on trying to tease out right now. So compare how the transport of these pollutants was in 2019 compared to 2020. I actually have a model that predicts the distribution of global NO2, but I use the same emission inventories for both years. So any differences that I see in that model, I can attribute just to changes in the direction that the wind's blowing.
With these kind of pollutants, do we tend to suffer the impact of them, you know, where the traffic is most intense, say where the most emissions are, or is it the people who live downwind of those who end up seeing most of the actual pollution settling?
So the actual NO2 concentrations are definitely highest right near the sources. And in fact, the Wisconsin DNR, who is another agency that's collaborating on this work, has near road monitors that we're using to also track the change due to the pandemic. So NO2 is highest right near the roadside. But again, the pollutants that we're concerned most about are ozone and aerosols, and those are formed downwind from those pollutant sources. And so, in fact, you can often see higher pollution concentrations away from the source regions. And that's something in particular that happens along the western shore of Lake Michigan in Wisconsin.
As we wrap up, Brad, what's the timeline for your project in this unusual learning opportunity?
Well, I'm working with my partners now. We're putting the pieces together. I hope to get a proposal out to NASA in the next couple weeks. And because this is a rapid proposal request, it's 1 year of funding. So we would hope to have some firm ideas about what is going on this year by July of next year sometime.
Brad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Rob.
That's Brad Pierce, director of the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about a project he's working on to measure the impact of reduced auto travel on air quality in the Midwest. I'm sorry, the academic program director of the UW-Madison Space Science and Engineering Center. Coming up, we'll talk about what happened in the state Supreme Court during oral arguments in the lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's stay-at-home order. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, while restoring ancient temples and collecting ancient artifacts sound like tasks out of a modern-day video game, those were actually a few of the options if you had the privilege to take up a hobby way back in the day. We'll talk about hobbies past and present with a historian and hear about yours. Now, the state Supreme Court is mulling over whether to strike down Wisconsin's stay-at-home order. Justices heard arguments this morning on a Republican lawsuit seeking to end it. The order is set to expire on May 26th, the day after Memorial Day. But Republicans say Department of Health Services Secretary-designee Andrea Palm overstepped her authority when she extended the original order nearly 3 weeks ago. State law allows the health secretary to take action to shut down parts of public life to control epidemics. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court is being asked to take up a second lawsuit against the so-called Safer at Home order. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, good to have you back with us.
Hey, Rob.
Well, let's start, before we get into the why and what, let's start with the how. This is an unusual online court proceeding.
It is, yeah. I mean, we're debating the state's response to COVID-19, and as you know, they were doing that in the court today, you saw the court's response to COVID-19. They met virtually. There was one justice in the courtroom, Chief Justice Patience Rogensack. The other justices were elsewhere, so were the attorneys arguing this case. So this is something that they are living with, even as they are asked to address it.
Explain the part of this law that the Republican challenge hangs on here, Sean.
This is all about the Safer at Home extension that DHS Secretary Andrea Palm issued at the direction of Governor Tony Evers. So I mean, this is the big order basically that takes that remains in effect until May 26th, unless something changes. And the lawsuit is saying that Andrea Palm exceeded her authority when she issued this order because she did not first run it past the legislature through an administrative rulemaking. So essentially, Republicans want her to issue any future orders through administrative rules. So they want the court to not only strike down this existing order in its entirety, they want future orders to go to them so that Republican lawmakers in this case have an up or down vote or, you know, veto power, essentially.
Conservatives hold a 5-2 majority on the Supreme Court. I want to give a listen to Justice Rebecca Bradley, who's considered to be on the the current makeup of the court. I think that's changing soon, considered to be on the conservative wing.
Isn't it the very definition of tyranny for one person to order people to be imprisoned for going to work, among other ordinarily lawful activities? Where does the Constitution say that's permissible, counsel?
Does that reflect the general tone, Sean, from the conservatives today?
Yeah, I think we can very safely say now that Justice Rebecca Bradley is the most outspoken conservative justice on this court, maybe the most outspoken justice. So, you know, her attacks against the lawyer for the Evers administration were definitely the most aggressive. She compared the safer at home order to tyranny and stated she, you know, sometimes justices kind of play devil's advocate and it's dangerous to guess where they're actually leaning because they're scrutinizing the attorneys that are arguing in this case. Rebecca Bradley is not doing that. She stated that she has problems with the amount of authority that was delegated to Andrea Palm in this case. So, I mean, I think you can very safely assume that she is going to be one of the justices that wants to strike this down.
Now, I want to listen to Colin Roth, attorney for the Evers administration, saying, hey, bad stuff is going to happen if this is struck down. Here's a listen. I don't have that audio. He said, I'll quote it, if safer at home is enjoined with nothing to replace it and people pour out into the streets, that the disease will spread like wildfire and we'll be back into a terrible situation of an out of control virus with no weapon to fight it, no treatments, no vaccine, nothing. So how did justices respond to arguments about the health outcomes of lifting safer at home too soon?
Yeah, so they didn't really get into alternatives if safer at home is lifted too much. They did talk a little bit about the potential that this could be that it could go to a county by county order. Actually, Justice Brian Hagedorn, one of the court's conservatives, asked, you know, could it be that the DHS secretary, if she doesn't have power to issue a statewide order, could she potentially issue an order for a specific county? And their lawyer for Republican lawmakers said yes. But if you're, you know, wondering what the Republican alternative in this case, well, they have talked about a regional approach. They haven't floated a concrete plan. And the alternative of, you know, a regional approach and the health ramifications were not really discussed in arguments, aside from that warning from the attorney for Evers.
It seems like the core issue legally, though, isn't is this tyranny or is this bad for health? It's, does the state constitution and empowering laws passed by the legislature allow the Department of Human Services Secretary or Health Services Secretary to do this stuff? Is that what's at the heart of this decision, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, that's the case that's brought by Republicans, is that that she can't do this, that you know, they're not floating an alternative plan. They're just saying that the plan has to go through the legislature. You know, the response from the DOJ representing Evers is that, you know, look, you may think justices, he was speaking to Justice Rebecca Bradley at the time, you may think that this is too broad of a grant to authority to the DHS secretary, but you should take that up with the legislature, because a previous legislature is what said is who granted the DHS secretary that power to address, you know, communicable diseases. You know, that this is spelled out in state law that the secretary of the DHS has these powers. And so it's, you know, their case is that it's the qualm should not be with Secretary Andrea Palm for exercising these powers, but, you know, essentially with the legislature for letting them exist.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief, about oral arguments today in the state Supreme Court in a Republican challenge to the stay-at-home order. Now, Republicans, Sean, had come in and said, we want you to strike it down, but we want a six-day stay here to allow us and the governor to come up with a replacement plan. Does that oblige the Supreme Court to, if they decide to overturn it, give that six-day stay?
No, so this could get really complicated in a hurry, okay? They're asking for a stay of the stay-at-home order, first of all. But essentially, when Republicans filed this lawsuit, they did ask this – let's use the word freeze just for kicks here. They did ask the court to basically freeze everything in place for 6 days to give the governor's administration and the legislature time to, you know, craft an administrative rule to replace Safer at Home. The thing is, the attorney for the legislature conceded today that only would have worked if the Evers administration started drafting that rule right away, and that really the quickest that the administration could now draft a rule by law is 12 days. The Evers administration says it's more like 20 days. And so, you know, if the court wants to step in and say, look, we're going to strike this down, but we're going to give you, the governor, some time to draft a replacement, I'm not sure what the right number is. I don't think it's six. It might be 12. It might be 20. The point is they can't turn around and do this tomorrow if they want to go through the normal rulemaking process, which is extremely cumbersome.
Well, I'm looking at the date, Sean. If they issued an order tonight or maybe tomorrow, you could say, okay, that's May 6th. If they go with the 20 days, that's May 26th, which is when the whole thing's supposed to end anyway.
You're getting right up next to it. Yeah. And actually, I mean, this is kind of a tangent here, but the court, and I mentioned they've done their own things to address COVID-19. They issued an order way back in March that delayed jury trials until at least May 22nd. So, one way or another, changes are going to be on the horizon here.
Now, this is just one lawsuit being heard today. Can you tell us a little bit about a second lawsuit challenging Safer at Home orders?
Yeah, I think the thing to know is that this lawsuit here is, you know, in many ways the most broad lawsuit, because it is asking the court to strike the whole thing down and to say that, you know, any future orders have to go through the legislature. We don't know if the governor and lawmakers can really agree on anything, given how far they are apart on this stuff. So the thing they heard today would strike everything down. The thing that the lawsuit that was filed yesterday is by private citizens, and it is challenging individual rights that they say are challenged by these safer at home orders, you know, the right to free speech, the freedom to practice religion, to travel. They're saying all of this is at odds with this safer at home order. And so they're going at the case in that way. They're trying to file an original action before the Supreme Court, which is just a way of saying, you know, send it right to the court first and not go through the normal court system and appeal process. And the Supreme Court did today issue a briefing schedule for that case to decide whether or not they want to take it. So it has their attention, and it would have pretty real ramifications, but it's not as broad as what the court heard today.
And I guess if the court ruled in this case and struck down Safer at Home, then that other lawsuit wouldn't matter anymore. Its concerns would already be addressed.
Yeah, potentially. Although there is a chance that what the court does with today's case is not essentially like a clean up or down ruling. You know, just it's probably dangerous to read the tea leaves on this one, but when you have some justices asking about the prospect of, you know, could the DHS secretary issue orders that are county specific or north of Highway 29, you know, stuff like that, it seems like it maybe opens the door to an order that is not like a clean yes or no. Same thing with that, you know, the stay or freezing the status quo. When you got some people talking about 6 days, 12 days, longer, it may be kind of what they ultimately put out there may leave some of the order intact potentially.
We'll leave it there, Sean, and watch for a ruling from the court. We don't know when that's going to be. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked to him about Wisconsin Republicans' lawsuit that seeks to end the state's stay-at-home order. The state Supreme Court heard arguments from both sides today, and the order is set to expire on May 26th. Geology and geoscience are about a lot more than just rocks, but sometimes they are about rocks. And in a UW class, they got a guest appearance from a very particular rock. In his last in-person lecture before turning to virtual instruction, UW-Madison professor Stephen Myers surveyed his Geology 101 class about what they wanted out of their online learning experience. One request, they wanted to find out what wrestler turned actor Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson had to say about geology. Myers took them seriously. I guess he'd made analogies about The Rock during the class. So he started up a Twitter campaign and posted questions from the 428 students for The Rock to answer. And he did. Quoting, "My favorite geological place would be Kilauea Volcano in Hawaii. You can literally walk up and look at the lava slowly yet relentlessly moving, and you have no choice but to respect its power and beauty." The Rock went on, "Some of my favorite and most intriguing geoscience topics are seismology, Mother Nature rules, paleontology, and oceanography. And as for my favorite rock, well, from the three scientific classes of rock, sedimentary, metamorphic, and igneous, I'd have to go with the big, brown, bald, tattooed rock. That's my favorite species of rock. And if all your 428 students want a big, fat A in this class, then that better be their favorite rock, too." His answers will be used in an end-of-session presentation from Myers on living in an uncertain world, complete with some local rock music. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.